Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. Tau Ili Ili Alpha Maeva is in the middle of filming an eight-part documentary series. He's tracing eight endangered or extinct instruments across the Moana. The project is an extension of Alpha's award-winning podcast, Sounds of the Moana. Alpha is also a musician and former member of the Mount Veya Band, with four tracks featuring on the Sione's Wedding soundtrack. He is now the Moana Pacific Music's Specialist at Sound Centre for New Zealand Music. Tau Ili Ili, Talo Falava, and welcome.
Māori, Māori, Talo Falava. Kia ora, kia kurahi, kia kunui, tēnā koutou katoa. Critics.
Oh, I love it. Tau Ili Ili, let's start with your dad, because I've heard you speak of him very fondly. What makes you feel that way about him?
Well, my father is, and look, everyone speaks who has a good relationship with their father would probably say the same, but he's a hero of mine, probably one of the only men that I look up to in my life, mainly because of the things that he has achieved with the time that he currently walks the earth. My father was Samoa's first indigenous pilot back in the 70s, when that profession was only reserved for those who were part Samoan and part European, or Western, or part Langi, and also, or mostly the expat community. So most of the profession that were reserved for indigenous peoples of Samoa were things like teachers, a lot of the, what's very limited, and we're talking about Samoa post-independence. So for my father to come out and be a pilot and then had to go through the journey that he went through. So my father his profession is actually an automotive engineer. But he got skipped by a lot of scholarships that were supposed to take him to Germany for Volkswagen and all of that, mainly because of nepotism that existed in Samoa class society of that time. Remember, post-independence, we still had a lot of afakasi or half-caste-dominated industries, right, where most of the natives, like myself, an indigenous person, were the laborers as best as we could. So Papa then moved to Aotearoa and first of all became an automotive came to Aotearoa as an automotive engineer and then went into aeronautics engineer and in New Zealand at the time, went back to Samoa, highest qualified person in the hangar, but wouldn't employ him because there was a Balangi who was, to my father's recollection, was the least qualified of them all. And to add more insult to the wound, he put my father in the septic tank division. Now, those of you who are young and don't understand what I'm just saying, back in those days, in those old aircraft, when it lands, people had to physically remove the septic tank, take it to the back, and you have to dump it there and then really attach it back into the plane. So my father didn't, he thought he would have come back with a qualification, but because he was still an indigenous Samoa, that's where they put him. So Dad said, all right, I'm going to prove you wrong. So he returned to Aotearoa and went back to flying school and then returned back to Samoa as a pilot, but they wouldn't take him. So my father then went across to American Samoa. And at that time, there was an airline service called SPIA, Sub-Pacific International Airways. It was owned by a Papalangi couple. And they saw my father already had the hours to be a captain instead of a first officer. So on his first day, they hired him as a captain because of the qualification he gained from Aotearoa. And then lo and behold, Samoa expected the inaugural flight of this new airline And there was, as Bob Marley would sing, the stone that the builder refused became the cornerstone. So that's why my father is a hero to me. And most of Sam Moore's in the industry of aviation. Papa is 73, still flying 50 years later. Still one of the longest serving pilots, not just Sam Moore, but the Pacific. So just a small snippet of my father. That's why he's a hero to me.
What about your mum? How much did she also smash ceilings?
Well, look, for every yin, there's a yang, right? So my father is someone that is, as what he does within the Western world or profession. But mom's an accountant. She's been a banker for a long time. And my mom is a village girl. That means that whenever father would fly, you know, most pilot wives would like to go with their husbands and experience the world. My mom decided to stay home and just, you know, let her husband do the thing of the traveling around. But my mom comes from a paramount family in Nofali, the village where she grew up, which is the Tanuwasa and the Taimalia family. She's the eldest of her families. And my parents actually were the funniest thing that happened in the 70s, because starting from, well, 50s on, earlier than that, a lot of tangata moana started to leave their home islands to go into the New Zealand and the Australia, the big wigs of society. And but my parents met in Aotearoa, and in the middle of the 70s, while everybody was leaving, they actually went back to Samoa and raised us. So it was a big call, and that's because mom is the eldest of her family, and they needed to look after their parents. So my parents were quite funny kind of pioneers, everything about it, because while everyone was moving to be cold and work in the factory or get educated, these two came here, met. Mom used to work for BNZ, got his qualifications of flying, and decided to go home. So in that sense of a word, my mom is quite historical in the culture aspect in her own way. But my father's very quiet. My mom is... well, yin and yang. If father is, she's fire.
And with this yin and yang, what philosophies were you raised with?
Well, I was raised by a house of women. In my house, my grandmother was one of the first Tanuwasa. So Tanuwasa is the title of the village in Nofani that I was raised in. And these titles are mostly and mainly reserved for the men. And remember that Samoa, different villages have different rules or protocols. So some villages, they title women, and others don't. My village is one of the ones that do allow women to be titled. But my grandmother was the eldest. But when she was with the title, she wanted to give it to her brothers, honoring what we call in Samoa whenua, the relationship between brother and sister. But she ended up getting the Tanuwasa title. But I grew up in a house where she was the one who wore the pants. I mean, my grandfather was just there as her sidekick. Paris Hilton, well, that was the handbag. Not that he minded, but that was the house that raised me, right? Very strong women. I was raised that never back down on anything. Be polite, but be aggressive in a very nice manner. I think they call it in the Papalangi world, passive aggressive. We just call it smiling during daytime and efficient when the pain is down. I just grew up in that house. And my father, being a pilot, I grew up a privileged life. But we grew up in a village life, you know. But I got to travel since I was a baby. And my father used to bring home books. And so one of the first books that I remember was the picture books of the Trans-Siberian Railway. Still one of my bucket lists. I'm going to write that train because it goes through, I think, four countries. And it has a multi-purpose depending on which part of the world it crosses in. And that's how my imagination of the world started. It was because of the house I was raised in. Very in-depth in terms of the Fasamua, entrepreneurial people. Just normal, as we call it, fobs going about life, trying to figure out how we exist in this new world that now includes globalization and the early form of westernization, if I would say.
Mm. In that house, how did your love for music start?
Well, as you know, someone who grew up in the islands, music is one of those things that you love it and then both shove it down in the same pipeline when it comes to religiosity, right? So we go to church, whether you like it or not, you have to sing. And then music has always been around. It's another one thing. Sound has been a part of us. And I grew up during a time when Christianization has already dug deep into society in Samoa. So everything was religious based. But even before that, we still have our cultural songs. So music was a big part of it. I mean, you hear it every day, whether it's funerals or weddings. I don't know if people sing in divorces, but I think some families in Samoa sang without telling anyone what it was for. Whether we pray, eat, love, or get a hiding, you have to cry in a tune or else they think that it's not hard enough. But yeah, it's a big thing. I mean, anything from the Moana, you know, sounds. Not so much music. I always say it's sound because I always say that music is a categorization of sound. And music is not our word. It was how they categorized when they heard it. They were like, oh, that's a happy music. Music was part of the categorization when the anthropologists, the ethnomusicologists, the historians came into our cultures and started to categorize the sounds into happy music, sad music, wedding music, religious music, and all of that. So when you were asking whether music and sounds has always been a part of my upbringing, I'd say sound has always been a part of that life. It's how we sail. It's how we navigate. And if you beat to Samoa, when somebody gets titled, you hear their name announced, not in a sentence, but in a form of poetry and motion and in a sound.
Besides the voice, what instruments or sounds were you raised with?
The usual, you know, the piano, if you were at church, if you could afford a piano to start with, but mostly the mat or the fala. And that was very limited in terms of the Samoan instruments that I encountered when I grew up, and also the silo. So in the Moana, and you'll find this everywhere at the moment, you get a bass, and now we use a bucket, and you put a string under the bucket with a big stick, and you hold it, and it's like a bass guitar. And what I'm guessing from the research and what we've encountered, it must have been influenced by the standing bass that would have come into our cultures by the papalangis and by the visitors and those who came and settled and brought these instruments with them. So that's those, I mean, and what I know now, what I didn't know then, I used to call, oh, I grew up with very Samoan instruments, you know, the guitar. And,
yeah.
But those were the ones that were presents.
You moved to Aotearoa on a rugby scholarship at the age of 15. Why did you end up pursuing music over sport?
Look, plain and simple, just in case everyone that's listening will play with me. I'm an awful rugby player, but I needed to get out of the right? I was someone who grew up with an artistic head. My imagination totally outpassed my village. And because of culture and because there's not much else you can do in the islands, I used rugby to get out of Samoa. And I vowed never to return because I wanted, you know, everybody's seen Michael Jackson, the TV, that, you know, I remember somebody used to bring the tapes of, was it the Young Talent Times? Mm. I think it was in Australian back in the days, right?
Yeah.
Similar to the Mickey Mouse Club that birthed the now freed, oops, I did it again, girl. But, you know, that's why I left Samoa using rugby. And when I got to New Zealand, no surprise, I was still awful at rugby. So I started pursuing all the plays and all of that stuff that the school had to offer. And, yeah, started to live the thing that I couldn't do at home other than singing a choir.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber, and I'm speaking with Tau Ili Ili Alpha Maeva, who is tracing endangered or extinct instruments across the Moana. Tau Ili Ili, one of the instruments you're tracking is the nose flute. What different uses did this have across the Moana?
To answer your question, you must wait for the documentary. But until you know. What I can tell you now is, look, at some point, because all we had to go by was what was written, right? Sadly, most of the Tangata Moana knowledge holders that we currently have who studied or read a book by either Dr. Richard Moyles or Adrian Kepler or Hurst Fisher, all of these other Papalangi professors and professionals, is they recorded based on observation and also whatever our peoples at the time explained with them. And so a lot of us actually answered those questions. And the only thing that we know of is that whatever they wrote is what we think the instrument is, because we stopped indigenizing the process of what it would have done. But in terms of the nose flute, what we found so far is that it had more than just the original purpose of the nose flute wasn't to be a sound producing instrument. You know, for instance, some cultures, they use it as a breathing apparatus to train those who are about to go diving, because the same concept of it's the same concept, you need to dive. And most of our peoples in the Moana, we weren't swimmers. We were divers because we were purposeful. Yeah, you can swim if you want, but the only reason why we engage with the Moana is to feed. Right? We went on holiday just having a swim and a suntan in between. The Moana, we respect it. Remember that. We respect the sky, the earth, the wind, the ocean itself was our highway. So the nose flute has different names and it has different functions. In some cultures, it's a tool for the young lovers. In others, it's ceremonial. Others, it's opening spaces. But we always produce the same 5 to 6 notes.
What does it feel like for you to play the nose flute?
The same. It's quite a powerful in the fact that I'm learning how to journey back into to time, because I know the sound that I produced was exactly heard by my ancestors 200, 300, 400 years. And it's quite emotional for me, because these were some of the instruments we were, I don't know whether it was purposely shunned from us, but when I came into my life in Samoa, we didn't talk about this stuff, the knowledge of them, their purpose, you know, who played them, were all gone. And if there was a question asked about them, the answer usually said something along with, oh, it was before Samoa was saved, right? So,
wow.
So as I got older, I'm like, saved from who and what? Mm. But what I realize now is they used to call these instruments quite devilish. It represented the monotone sound of, remember, what we went through when colonization arrived, it came through the sphere of religiosity. And anything that didn't match the 4/4 key of your choral system wasn't pleasing to the ear of those who brought the gospels. So our instruments, the way we sang and all of that stuff, were considered minor and therefore had to be stopped. I mean, and I'm not making this stuff up, one of the greatest European tours that they did was record what they thought of us, right? Probably thinking that we will never be smart enough to one day grow up to be able to understand what they wrote about us, but they did. There's a character by the name of Reverend William Woon. You can look this up online. He wrote, as you'll find in the podcast, that these songs are minor and that these Tongans don't know how to sing. But it's because, remember, how we sing in the Pacific, it's reflective of the only sound that we're used to, that is the waves, the wind, and the trees. So when we mimic what we hear, it's in the sound of nature. When we hear the birds, that's why in some cultures, we go halfway through the la, 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 la. It's reflective of a bird. Because our sound wasn't created for the entertainment purpose that's the Papalangi of the Western world treat music. Our sound was a communicative process, but it's also to pay respect for the gods who float the birds, the trees who we talk to and would give us a tree to carve a waka or a canoe, right? So that's how we communicated with sounds. And you have to understand, just like any part of the world, wherever two cultures with opposing beliefs come together, there are beautiful things that happen, like innovation and some marriages of great things. But then there's also cannibalization of the lighter by the bigger, depending on what goal. That's what happened to our sounds. And we were quite oblivious to it. You know, I can't speak for my ancestors, but as you know, as a Tangata Moana, we're very open. Our culture has never changed. It's always very hospitable. And that nature is more, it's beyond Christianity. It's a nature thing. And so as we, you know, said hello to these new exes, we said, yay, great. We don't have to stone tool down a tree that takes 4 weeks. we also said hello to other things like the piano or the guitar. And sadly, what we do know in some cultures, it's either we did a swap by acceptance or we had to do the swap by convert or other. And in that conversion, you must then shed your old skin to make room for this new kingdom that's about to provide you with sweeter juice and berries that we're all allergic to.
Tell Ili Ili, you don't have to give it all away, but what can people expect from your upcoming documentary? What other instruments will be featured?
Well, in terms of the significance of this project, this will actually be the first time where you will get glanced into what are or what were or what once were the sound-producing instruments of the Muna. If you are a Tanata Moana who grew up and by choice you were told to not speak and learn about your language because you grew up in Aotearoa, Australia, and America, and you've gone through your identity journey and you realize, I want to start coming back to mine, but I've lost so much of the language. This documentary will hopefully help you make your way back into your culture. And we do know that language might be hard to understand and speak, but sound will always bring you back to who you are. So that's one. And to someone who's curious, you know, were these islanders ever originate anything? Well, you're about to find out. So it's a duality in terms of what it offers those who love sounds and music. But most of all, to be honest, this is a love letter to my kids. I don't know if they're going to be 100 years, but if this is going to help them, because I know that in the future, there might be a Samoan community in the moon. And we do know we can't take physical things, but we can only take our stories and our sounds. Hopefully, this will be one of the things that will always, we say in Samoa, pipi'i le'ama, it means you can go swimming, but make sure you hold on to the oar of the waka so that you don't lose yourself. This, hopefully, will be that oar to make sure as my babies and the babies of the Moana grow up, build communities in Russia, Ukraine, or the moon, that there are things that they can hold on to that are considered aesthetics of who they are.
Sounds incredible. What has fascinated you most about this work?
The fascination has come with regards to just a plethora of things that we thought we weren't capable of, that we are discovering has always been in our power. One of the greatest mysteries about people that they took away is they took away the power of storytelling and swap it with the pen and paper. And we believed it. And we believe that only great Sumerians and the great Akkadians and the great builders of the Ark were the only societies worth knowing. But what I've come to discover is that I am and you are the sons and daughters of the greatest navigators the world has ever seen. We didn't read and write because we didn't need to. We only read what was needed. That's the stars. We didn't need to write things down because we memorized as part of our journey to make sure when you learn about your family, you don't read about it. It's ingrained into your mind, into all you are. So those are some of the discoveries that I've come to wonder in. And I do hope that as I get to share these stories with people, that in some way it helps them with whatever they're going through. My fascination is around the power of our peoples. That this Moana is the mother, and the house of Samoa, Tonga, Kiribati, richest houses within one village. That is ever so true because that's how these instruments got together. While diplomacy might separate us, these sounds, it unites us all.
How do you feel knowing this knowledge was at risk of being lost?
There is a responsibility that comes with this. And so I say this a lot of time. The urgency that we're discovering around the reservation and the preservation of our indigenous instruments is the same DNA that you're finding around climate change. We are all fighting to maintain something in threat of the one thing that used to connect us. The waters of the Moana was a highway. It is now threatening our way of life. And we are at this point of time where we're trying to preserve, conserve, and just reserve as much as we can before the water takes it away. So when it comes to the sounds, you have to understand these tools are made from the plants found in the islands. And the reason why the nose flute is different in Fiji and Tonga and Samoa, because those from bamboo, the bamboo strand is different in these islands. And as seawater starts to creep in to these lands, it's going to impact the tree. It's going to impact the fact that in the Cook Islands, the sounds of the pate is different up in northern Cooks down to the southern because of the trees they use. These are the things that are impacted by climate change. So the same strand of worry is now faced by whatever's left over in terms of these instruments. Because as we fear that in the cases of Kiribati and in the cases of Panapan, we'll now move on to Rambi Island, for instance, oh, now facing the same thing. Tokelau, Niue. Well, Niue, they're on a rock. It's going to be some time before we get up there. But the water is receding and it's impacting the ground that grows these instruments. And when these trees no longer grow, we will now be able to not make these anymore. Therefore, really sitting in the extension basket for a very, very long time. And yes, someone said, well, you know, Tony, you can now 3D prints of Fungu Fungu. It's like, yeah, just the same way I can 3D print my hand. But it ain't the original, is it? But if we reserve the stories, hopefully, even if they 3D print me in 100 years, at least it has the story to go with it so that it's not just the existence of the physical, but the presence and support of the metaphysical.
Finally, Tauili'ili, when I saw you speak in 2023, I also saw your daughter play the nose flute. What was it like watching a child play an endangered instrument and give it life again?
One of the greatest pride of a father and a mother and a parent is to see the things that you dedicate your life to being shared by your kids. For my children, they have no choice because they grow up around me and my house is filled with music. And so somebody is bound to pick something up. But it was great joy. That was the first time my baby daughter, her name is Yamilina, got to play in front of an audience other than just within our house. And if you are Samoan and you're listening and you're unfamiliar with the word fangu fangu, that's because we lost it back in 1800s. So my daughter is now the only Samoan female that now plays the instrument that was taken away from us. So for me, having my daughter play, and not just play, but the girl loves the instrument to the point where she plays better than me. It's a joy for me because now I know part of the reason why I build these things, I have a child that's interested in it, giving me the kind of comfort feeling that there is someone that's going to continue doing this, who hopefully would pass it on to her babies and so forth and so forth. And then, you know, we could continue this revival or the bringing back of the art. But in saying that, I want to acknowledge the Tongan man who taught a Samoan to revive our Fangu Fangu. His name is Tuifonualava Kaivelata. He is the movement of Ikuleho Unu Aho from the village of Kanakubolu in Tonga. And so, look, like I said, politics and the stories of us were written at Samoans and Tongans had problems with each other. But I learned this from a Tongan man. It's because the narratives they wrote about us were not true. We've always been one people. And to find that out, we have the same instrument.
Tauili'ili Whaafetailava, thank you for restoring the knowledge of sound.
Well, look, I am not going to sit here and lie to you. These knowledges are not mine. It's because the people that I talk to gifted to me. And so therefore, I must acknowledge everyone that took the time to share the gift of their ancestors with me. And so therefore, it is only right for me to pass on something that was never mine to acquire and keep, but to acquire and share so that more and more of it echoes to our generation. And thank you very much, Whaafetai Tere Lava, and I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Tauili'ili Alpha Maeva, Moana Pacific Music Specialist at Sound Centre for New Zealand Music. You can listen to his podcast by searching for Sounds of the Moana. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To catch more great stories about incredible people from the Pacific, just search for ABC Pacific. This story was produced on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people.